Welcome back, everyone. I am Dr. Beth Trammell, your host, a licensed psychologist and an associate professor of psychology at Indiana University East, where I am the director of the Master's in Mental Health Counseling program. And I am really excited about today because this is a topic that I've kind of just sort of loosely kind of known about. It feels like maybe it was around when I first started training, but it maybe wasn't as popular. It wasn't as widely known. I don't know, but I'm excited about our talk today. And just a quick reminder that today and all of the episodes are not meant to replace the work of therapy, but really just to kind of add to maybe any work that you're doing in therapy, or maybe to inspire you to go find your own therapist. Today, I am here with Dr. Jen Blanchett, and she's a psychologist who has a practice, and we're going to talk about kind of all the things she does. She has a podcast too, but today we're going to talk about EMDR and what that means. What do those letters mean, and what does it mean in the therapy room, and should I ask about EMDR for my therapist? But before we get into all that, Dr. Jen, can you introduce yourself to listeners and tell us one fun thing about you?
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. So I'm Dr. Jen Blanchett. I am the host of TBI Therapist podcast, and I am a licensed psychologist here in the state of Maine. My business here is New Life of Maine, and I have been in private practice for about 8 years and working with folks after brain injury for about 10 of those years, and in mental health for over 20 years. And I have really found, I think, my lane with therapy and EMDR, and it really has changed the way I conceptualize trauma, nervous systems, everything. So I think I now see people through the lens of the nervous system. I see people through the lens of trauma. And I think EMDR is that modality that helps me, number one, get faster results. I think it helps me kind of cut through things that I don't think we need to work on. I'm like, okay, I'm seeing this problem in your body. Let's work on that. Versus in my training, it was much more related to your thinking, not so much how's your body responding.
That's good. Okay. So that's a lot of fun things about you. But is that, was that your one fun thing?
The fun thing is that I am an avid tennis player, and I just, I'm nutty about tennis. So I just think about it all the time and thinking about it, my shots, and just love it.
That is so fascinating. Okay. So I just started, I don't know, maybe like 4 or 5 weeks ago, doing this cardio tennis class at the Y, at my local Y. I think last week, it's just once a week, right? And there's like half of us are pretty good. They're pretty decent, you know, tennis players. And then the other half are, I don't know, maybe like the B team. I don't know. And I missed the ball last time, like more frequently than I usually do. And I was like, I really suck at tennis. So anyway, I am really, I love tennis. I'm just not that good at it. It just feels like there's so much skill required to, like.
You need like 5 good lessons with a pro. So if you haven't had a one-on-one lesson with a pro, you just have to do that, because the stroke technique takes forever. I played since I was 10. So
it feels like I might need more than 5, Dr. Jen. I'm not sure.
Tennis is for everyone. I will quote you all the research on tennis players and longevity. You need tennis.
I do love tennis. It's so fun, and it's such a good workout, and we have fun, but
very
great.
Special.
I love that you're a tennis player. That's really fun. Okay.
And a Zumba instructor. I didn't add that.
Zumba and tennis?
Yes. I've always danced. So.
Wow. There's so many fun things to talk about there.
We could just talk fitness and.
Hey. Look, there's a lot of ways that we learn about fitness. Those are things you learn in therapy too. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. Now that we're, I'm just picturing myself doing Zumba, because I've done Zumba several times, and my body just doesn't seem to look like the instructors. Can't quite figure that out.
There is no body type for Zumba.
No, I mean more like when their body moves and I try to make my body move that way. I look in the mirror, and remarkably,
you're just doing a solo. That's what that is.
I'm in the back of the room doing a solo. I like that reframe. That's good. Okay. So let's talk EMDR here. Okay. So let's just start with, okay, if there's a person listening and they're like, I've never heard of EMDR. What, I don't know what you're saying. What are those letters and what do they mean? How do you explain EMDR to sort of the regular person?
Right. So I can talk about the letters really quickly. So it's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. And so that's a lot of words, number one. And people, I say that and people are like, what?
What? What are you talking about my eye movements? What do you mean?
Right. So I think people are already like, well, that sounds weird. And I don't know what that is. But essentially, it is an evidence-based trauma therapy. And the eye movements, which if you are, you're not on video, but people follow my fingers, or you can use a light bar, and their eyes would move side to side, which kind of imitate REM sleep. And the thinking is the eye movements are helpful in using both sides of the body, both sides of the brain. So reprocessing in that way by using a bilateral stimulation, eye movements are one way. So I also specialize in treatment after brain injury. So I typically never use eye movements with someone after concussion or brain injury because there's vestibular issues, which is inner ear problems, ocular problems. So I will use tapping or a butterfly hug. Well, I'll link my thumbs together. I'm doing that for you. And we'll do bilateral tapping. So tapping is one way. I also have a thing called a TheraTapper in which it will buzz lightly in the hands. And so there's multiple modes of bilateral stimulation we could use. So both sides of the brain, both sides of the body. Also, I think bilateral movement helps a client stay more present in the room. So in EMDR, we always talk about the window of tolerance. We want someone to stay in their window that they're not 2 feet deep in that trauma and they're not in the room with me. So I'm always talking about, are you with me right here in the room? Because I don't want you to feel like you're so far in that trauma, you are lost or dissociating, which could mean kind of out of our body for the moment. And it is very common in trauma. So I want you to be present with me. And I think bilateral movement can be helpful in that presence and staying more present in the room through your trauma. And essentially, EMDR goes in 8 phases. So the first phase would be history and treatment planning. So I'm going to get a detailed history on what trauma you're bringing in. Also, I've used it for panic disorder, so panic attacks, other issues like relational problems or what quote unquote little t traumas or things that felt in the nervous system that they were threatening or dangerous, but aren't to the category of a big T trauma, not a life-threatening event. But it really doesn't matter because in the nervous system, if there's threat, if there's danger, then it feels that way to the body. And I sometimes see this with my clients after brain injury. Their sensory system is out of whack. They go to the grocery store, they're overstimulated, and all of a sudden the grocery store becomes dangerous, even though there was no life threat there. There's no difference in the body. The body feels like I'm in danger, I'm in threat, and I need to get the hell out of here. We also do EMDR for things that felt dangerous in the body. So history is the first phase of EMDR. We get a detailed history. And I think for my clinicians that might be listening to this, I think adding the caveat that we don't want to go deep into a trauma and a history taking. We want to get the age and the headline, and then we're making a note, we're moving on. So we're just getting the highlights, and we're not going into that memory because we don't want to re-traumatize someone before they're ready to go into that. And also thinking about the target sequencing that we need to go in, which EMDR has thoughts about that too. So I'll just run through those phases really quickly. So phase 2 would then be preparation. We spend a lot of time preparing. So deep breathing, there's techniques that EMDR specifically uses like calm place. And we find like a calm imaginal place. We use a multi-sensory relaxation strategy in EMDR, and we teach that to go home. So I want them practicing calm, safe place at home as well. If all of that pans out and we're prepared, we're ready to go, then we can go into the assessment phase where we're going to start that reprocessing of the memory. So that's phase 3. Then phase 4 would be the desensitization part. So that's when we're actually doing, we're bringing up that memory, we're desensitizing either through eye movements, through tapping, through whatever, that what needs to happen is you're remembering the trauma, but your body is feeling safe. So that's what we want to happen. There's no physiological distress in the body anymore at the end of the desensitization period. So we want a subjective unit of distress scale to be a zero at the end, ideally. Sometimes we get an ecological one, which would be their zero, which I'm okay with. It's not a bad thing to do that. And then we go into phase five. I'm kind of glossing over some things here for the sake of time.
Sure, sure.
Which is installation. So we're installing a positive cognition with the new way they are remembering the event because it changes. It's like this magical thing, that this pivot that happens in EMDR where the event changes. And it doesn't change a memory, but it changes the way the memory is stored. So before, the memory was stored as distressing, traumatic, my heart races, my palms are sweaty when I think of this. And now, oh, I can get through that. And I can speak a little bit as the client, if you'd like me to, about my experience of EMDR too, and what that looked like for me. And then we have phase six body scan. So then we check the body. We're going to go all through that body. And us backing up to phase three, we also ask what's happening in the body too. So we go back again through the body. Let's go head to toe. What are you noticing? Do you notice any unusual sensations? Oh, you know, I do feel something in my stomach. There's that little pit there. Okay, let's see what there is. We might have to go back into reprocessing then if there's something left in the body. Seven is closure. We close it up. And we use any of those safety techniques that we needed to use in seven if we have to. And then eight would be reevaluation. So when they come back, I always start with what we did last session and check in on that actual target.
I love this. Okay, so I want to summarize what I'm hearing and then clarify if I've missed any of the parts that are, you know, that are important. And you know, we're going to talk here toward the end about where folks can get training. So if you're a clinician that's like, wow, that sounds like that's a way I want to do therapy, we're going to talk about where you can get training. And that neither of us are affiliated with this, but we're just kind of sharing some resources. But okay, so we've kind of got these eight stages, but this isn't linear, right? This isn't like you start at the beginning and you end at the end and there's no like kind of looping back, right? Like, you're sort of saying like, we may have to go back to stage three for some parts, or we may have to remember, you know, this isn't just a, oh, well, week one is stage one, week two is stage two, right? I want people to hear that this process may be much lengthier than that. And it's not just once you've achieved body scan, you know, then you're like almost done or cured or whatever, you know, like.
Right, right. Yeah, I would say the process is different for each person. So some people, I've been in phase two 4 months.
Yeah.
Because safety and stabilization is the goal. So if that is a person that comes into EMDR treatment and they struggle with safety, if they have not felt relative psychological or emotional safety ever in their lives, then we are developing all kinds of resources in that phase. So their lengthy process in phase two is warranted. Right. And I would say for some folks, like they get stuck in phase three or phase four. So they're getting stuck and we have techniques to help us to get those memories unstuck. But maybe they have a hard time getting to phase five, or we have to find a new target because this one is stuck or it's related to a past target, which frequently happens. Oh, well, this is really related to, you know, when I was in high school and I didn't feel like I belonged and you know, I didn't have peers that really cared about me. This is what this is more related to, not, you know, my coworker shutting me down in lunchroom. So it could be related to something more in the past that we had to dig into for that individual.
You really find this to be a more effective way of doing therapy, particularly with trauma. And can you spend a minute kind of contrasting this to maybe the traditional form of trauma-related therapy that maybe a person who's listening has experienced, you know, kind of traditional talk therapy around trauma, where they really dug in and they spent a lot of time feeling and experiencing the emotion of their trauma? And, you know, maybe contrast that with kind of this process you're describing, both for kind of the general person who might be listening, but also for a therapist who might be interested in this.
Yeah. So someone who is looking for trauma treatment, I think it can work more quickly that's yeah. there's no guarantee on
sure.
speed.
Sure.
I think that it can be helpful in not having to verbalize. So we're not verbalizing like this was the event, this happened to me, and we're just talking through the whole time. I'm asking them to hold the picture of the image. So this is phase three. I'm going to break down phase three so it sounds more. So we're going to reprocess images. So that target image, the belief, their negative belief, like I can't hack this or I can't do this. Feelings, which would be sadness, disbelief, whatever it is. And then the body sensation. And then I'm going to get a SUD, which is a subjective unit of distress. 0 to 10, what is this like for you? Okay, it's an 8. Oh, that's pretty high. And then we're also going to tap into the positive memory network there and ask, well, how do you want to feel when this memory comes up? Well, I want to feel like I can handle it or something like that. So it's usually an I statement for both the negative cognition and the positive cognition. And then we hold all those things together and then we desensitize. So, okay, just hold all those things together and then see what comes up next. And sometimes they just notice the eye movement. Sometimes they're like, oh, I'm feeling more distress. Okay, what can we do? Sometimes I change the eye movements if nothing moves. That's our first kind of line of defense with EMDR. So there's multiple ways that we can help things move along more quickly. But I think the difference in that is that the body sensations, the emotions, we're getting the truth from that client. I'm not interjecting into, oh, well, tell me more about this or what happened next. So the story isn't being processed verbally in the session. We're just running the scene. It's like it's actually happening right now. You have 1 foot there, 1 foot here in safety, but we're rerunning that scene for you. And I think it's less problematic than prolonged exposure, rather. Another therapy for trauma is prolonged exposure, where they just constantly bring up that event, And a lot of times it just gets stuck. So I think we have lots of tools to help things get unstuck with EMDR is what I notice. And we're bringing in all of that, the body sensation, the emotion, the negative cognition, and the positive, trying to figure out, well, how can this move? How do I want to feel? And I find that is really the key because we're trying to build into that positive memory network.
Yeah. So I love hearing about this as an alternative for some folks who maybe have only received training in kind of traditional approaches. One thing you mentioned before is that it doesn't change the memory. It changes the way the memory is stored, right? And so I think back to lots of folks who think therapy is just a waste of time. Talking about it isn't going to change it, right? What happened in the past happened in the past, and talking about it doesn't matter. I think there's a lot of folks who can relate to this idea of, you know, you're not going to change what happened. And I think that's the power of what you just said, is that even in talk therapy, that's not the goal. The goal is not to change what has happened. The goal is to shift the way we experience that memory. So I can imagine that being very empowering for people when they hear that that is the work of EMDR, and I do want to change the way I feel about that memory. I do want to change how that memory has been stored in my mind so I can do something about it. That's real powerful.
Another powerful thing about it is that the truth comes from the client. I'm not the one saying, oh, well, you know, you were just a little kid, and how can a little kid, you know, change any of that or do anything or had power to stand up for that type thing. I might ask them a question of, can a little kid stand up to their parent? And they might say, well, no, they can't. And I notice that. And then we do bilateral. So they feel like, what do I feel in my body? Or what am I noticing when those words are spoken to me? So it's really experiential.
So you've talked about kind of the movement, and what y'all can't see is that she kind of has two fingers up and she's just kind of moving them in front of her, you know, kind of off to the side, just a little bit of her body, and just kind of moving them back and forth in kind of the slow motion. Aside from maybe some of the tapping and the movement of your hand, what are other things a person could kind of like logistically expect about sessions? Is it still once a week? Are we talking 60 minutes, 90 minutes? What is kind of the logistics of how EMDR works so that a person could go into it kind of having a little bit of an idea of what to expect?
Yeah, so I think sessions tend to, at least in the US, tend to follow on the 50-minute hour because of insurance. So some clinicians that are private pay might tend to do longer sessions, like a 60-minute or a 90-minute session, but I don't think that's the norm, just based on insurance reimbursement here. I don't know about international treatment and how that typically goes, but the therapy was founded with longer sessions, with a standard 90-minute session. I just think we are limited here with regard to that. And it really depends on the person, what they need. Some people, I feel like, need that 90-minute session. Some people process very quickly, and or they're later in their treatment and they're just kind of a 30-minute processor. Then we're kind of wrapping up and that's their process. So what typically happens is the intake feels a little like the same, I would say, except we have nuances to what we're asking, of course, if you're trauma trained. And then it's pretty regimented, actually. You know, it doesn't feel like talk therapy. You're coming in, okay, I'm asking you these same four questions. Okay, what did you notice? Are there any changes in behavior? What did you notice about the incident we worked on last session? And then we're going right into that target. So there's less time for the kind of check-in, how are you doing? I mean, I do that, of course, because I'm human, but I try to speed that up a little bit because I know that they want to get into the memory. And some people do have two sessions with me a week where they'll come in and they'll do EMDR and they'll do a talk therapy session because they want to talk to me. And I'm like, okay, we can do that. I like, because I also like to catch up and see how things are going with them or how they're doing with their resources. But I've also done intensives where I've seen someone for multiple hours in a day and we walked through maybe phase one and phase two, and maybe we've opened up one target in that half day EMDR intensive, and it accelerates the therapy. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to reach a specific goal with their memory, but accelerates maybe phase two because we're able to spend more time sitting together and working on all their resources, for example. I find that helpful at the front end of the therapy because there's so much we need to get through for me to teach them the skills.
I love that you kind of mentioned that, you know, EMDR is kind of like a pretty regimented, there's not a whole lot of space for like a whole lot of other sort of conversation or, you know, maybe even other kind of struggles outside of this. So, you know, my experience, professionally with EMDR has been kind of working alongside an EMDR trained therapist where I still do kind of the talk therapy portion of talking through interpersonal challenges or maybe work challenges or that sort of thing. And not that we really experience things in a compartmentalized way, but that EMDR time is really specifically focused on kind of retraining the body around that particular trauma. So I don't know if that's a common practice, and that was kind of many years ago, but I appreciate you kind of mentioning that it may be twice a week. Once a week, we're kind of doing intensive EMDR, and then the other part of the week, we may be doing talk therapy.
It depends on the client and what they need. I mean, some are just EMDR, and that's all they need. They're pretty resourced. And I find that other clients that talk therapy session is a very supportive and rapport building session for them. So it really just depends on your client who's in front of you and what their needs are.
It's great. Okay. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, you kind of came to this through, you got some training and then you got more training. So maybe you want to share a little bit about your experiences, either personally or professionally, kind of to get to this point with specific focus on some resources for folks to consider if they think they want to do more training in EMDR.
So I was initially trained in EMDR probably in about, I don't know, 2013-ish, I think. Or 14, something like that. And I went through maybe like a 3-day training, and it was not MDRIA approved, which is the International Association for EMDR. And so that's MDRIA.org. I don't work for them, but it is a great resource. So certainly check that out. And I found that it was a great, I loved the training, but then I felt like, oh my gosh, this is kind of crazy a little bit. I'm dealing with people's trauma. I feel like it's a lot to hold. And I was just kind of like, you're trained and then go forth. And so I did it. I mean, I did a lot of that work, and I found that I felt more like held back in a way, that I was holding myself back, or I was feeling too scared to go open up someone's trauma without that support. So I did some where it felt appropriate. I'm like, okay, I know this client is really ready. I'm going to go forward. And maybe it was some of my long-term clients that had specific issues that I would do EMDR with them. And in the pandemic, I just made the decision, I think because trainings became virtual. And so a lot of it was logistically challenging for me to go to EMDR training, which is typically, I don't know how, I did it in like 4 weekends, I believe. So it's several hours of training and then 10 consultation hours. So it was like a 40-hour bundle with those consultation hours all together virtually, which I really recommend going in person if you can go to EMDR training. It's just a lovely training to do in person.
Yeah.
But I got it done. So that's also the good part of doing it virtually.
So doing this and then having support from someone who can kind of empower you to use these tools. Yeah, I think that that is the differentiation, right? And I think, like, if you're a therapist listening, I think we all can relate to that, right? We've left a training and we're like, I'm ready to use these tools. And then you get in front of the client and you're like, well, how did they do it? Or we try it, you know, and that's an ethical thing to do, is to try something new you've been trained in. And then it doesn't work, right? Or it doesn't work the way they say it's supposed to work. And then you're like, well, I guess I shouldn't do that anymore, you know, or so I love this idea of like really making an investment. That's what I hear you saying. It's like, it's almost making the investment.
And I'm thinking back a little bit to a situation clinically that I was ill-prepared for early in my career. I became traumatized by this situation. I won't say specifics, but it was a very difficult case. And I felt like I needed more training to handle someone's trauma. And all my training felt like, oh my gosh, it seems like such a nice person to help them through this thing that they were talking about. And then I walked into it and I just kind of dove 2 feet in. And I think the beauty of EMDR is that it gives a therapist some room too, because the client isn't verbalizing all the things. So secondary traumatic stress is a real thing. And I had to do my own EMDR work around that particular case. But I feel much more protected from secondary traumatic stress from this therapy model specifically, because I did not do EMDR with that client where I then became traumatized by that material. So I just, and that was a little bit of my catalyst, I think, for doing this training, because I was like, oh my gosh, this is a lot. And I became traumatized in my own therapy from it.
I love that you shared that, because I think if you're a therapist who wants to work with trauma, or you're someone who has been working with trauma for a long time and you're experiencing that secondary traumatic stress, as therapists, I think it's really hard to honor that in a way that's like practically meaningful. And so it's like, I know secondary traumatic stress is real. I know being a therapist can be a heavy job. You know, it's like logically, I know all of this, but meaningfully, I still am, you know, sometimes short with my own family, or I'm distant in my relationship. And it's probably directly related to those things, but meaningfully, I just don't know that we talk about it enough or honor it enough, you know? So I'm just so thankful to hear you say that and realize that.
And I think for someone who, I kind of prided myself on saying, like, you know, I can kind of like clinically manage a lot, you know, I'm good, I've got this. And what I've found now after being more seasoned therapist is that I never know what's going to necessarily happen when I walk in the room with a client. And I take that very seriously. And I take my self-care very seriously. I'm currently in therapy. I'll stay in EMDR therapy as the therapist as long as I do this work. And I find it just a tool that helps me stay present in the room, because otherwise I get distant and I'm like, okay, because that's what happened to me. I was like, okay, well, I don't know what's going to happen. So I have to kind of remove myself from the client more. And I found that that also doesn't work because the clients notice that.
It is such a powerful, I mean, this is the stuff they don't really teach you in training. We both are doctorally trained and, you know, they talk about self-care and they talk about, you know, how burnout is real, but it's like these specific moments, right? It's just hard to prepare. And I, you know, I direct a master's program where I'm training master's level therapists, and it's still hard for me to help them be ready for what you're describing, right? This, like, I don't know what my client's going to come in with. And particularly if I have, you know, any kind of unfinished business from my past, or I have, you know, stuff that I'm going on in my current life. currently in my life, you know, it's like, right, when a client comes in and then suddenly you're emotionally triggered, to your point, it's like, one, it's hard to prepare folks for that. But two, without having the right support and continuing in our own journey, you just can't be an effective therapist, because both things you're saying are true, right? Like, I can't be dysregulated and I can't withdraw.
Well, I find that being dysregulated is going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So yeah. Let's go there.
Yeah. So dysregulation will happen. It's, what do I do when it happens? Okay. This client, I was in session and it happens almost every week. I mean, I'm like, okay, like, I have something going on. Okay. What do I do? And I've been doing biofeedback. So I do some heart focused breathing. I'm just noticing that I'm aware of what's happening in my body and I'm completing the stress cycle. So what EMDR has taught me is that I need to complete that stress cycle. So there's lots of ways that I can do that. Exercise, number uno. So definitely think about exercise because it helps complete the stress cycle the best. And lots of other ways, like laughter. I'm, you know, I do Zumba, so I dance and try to move through it. Sometimes I do dance breaks in the bathroom at work because that kind of helps me tell my body, you know what, we got through that. We're safe now. That's over. And that's not our stuff. We can let that go. And unless I say those words to my body doesn't realize, and it's going to be anxious. And I know it by my cuticles, because my cuticles will tell the story. Because I'll start picking at them. And I don't even know it. And I'm like, oh, self-care is not getting great. There we go.
My cuticles tell the story.
They do.
That's so fascinating. Okay. I love everything you just said because I think it's so true. I think about my training, right? That, you know, we're supposed to check everything at the door. You have to leave all your stuff at the door. But the
not
whole
possible.
It's not possible. I mean, the
not
whole
possible.
Premise, everything you're saying, everything that we know is true.
Then you're not human. Then you're not human.
Yeah.
So leave your humanity at the door.
I know. It's so powerful. It. Like, even just pausing for me to think about that as a training director and as a you know, a teacher, a professor, a therapist myself, it's like, yeah, we want to have a response.
We'd want to.
We just can't let it be our own stuff that is the responding. Like, we've got to be able to know how to respond effectively, and our body may give us away in a different way, right? I mean, I think that's what we're talking about, right? Our body is going to respond.
You know, there's things that I learned to do in session. I learned to roll my shoulders back. I'm very aware of my breath in EMDR work. So when I'm doing this, I'm breathing. So
yeah,
I'm breathing audibly. So yeah. You can breathe audibly if you're listening.
Yeah.
And they tell us to do that in EMDR training. Breathe audibly so the client's neurobiology will also notice yours. Because even if you're not saying you're stressed, your body's telling the client you're stressed.
Mm.
And that's what, if you, the body keeps a score. Bessel van der Kolk talks a lot about that. And I think our neurobiology, we're co-regulating in session. So if we're the co-regulator and we're not aware of what our body is doing, then we need to take a step back and create more body awareness.
And it starts here. It starts with us first.
Yeah.
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 Ooh, child. It's good. I mean, it's good. It's good. I mean, even for therapists who aren't EMDR train, or for folks who have never heard of this, maybe you're not even a therapist, it's this co-regulation piece is real in all relationships, not just, you know, not just in the therapy room and not just with the EMDR trained folks. So I think it's a good, just general reminder that if we're in any kind of relationship where emotion exists, which is every relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Realizing our emotions and our body first for that co-regulation, it's got to be the first place to start.
Yeah. Yeah. Am I able to do this today? My dog started coming with me to treatment in the pandemic. He is also my co-regulator. Sometimes when I'm in session with a client, I'll pet my dog. And he's their co-regulator sometimes too. Like when they get animated, he's going in there.
Yeah.
He's great. So also animals can be our co-regulator. So there's lots of ways that we can kind of think through that. Deb Dana's work is wonderful on this. So if you haven't seen any of her work on the clinical application of polyvagal theory, certainly look at some of her stuff. She has a book. I don't remember the title off the top of my head, but it's a great resource.
Oh my gosh, you've given us so many resources. Okay, so tell folks again, what's your website? How can people find you, listen to your podcast also so they can follow you?
So I am an EMDR therapist. I work in the state of Maine and I'm at newlifeofmaine.com. That's my website there. You could also, if you want to travel out of state to come to an EMDR intensive, you can do that. You just have to be in Maine to do that. And it's a beautiful state, by the way. Also, my podcast is the TBI Therapist Podcast. I've worked with brain injury and concussion for the past 10 years. And so that podcast is specifically for survivors of brain injury. I also interview professionals. And I haven't talked so much on trauma there, but I do have an intention of bringing some of my knowledge regarding trauma to that podcast as well.
It's so good. I'm so thankful that you came on to share about this. I think, you know, some of the guests that I've had on previously also talked about a lot of these same things. And I love that therapists can kind of all talk about a similar idea, but in a different way so that we could just reach more people, right?
Yes.
I mean, just that's the goal.
Yeah. I think the goal is, you know, I think when I do the work and I see people experience less pain in their lives, I mean, that is the motivation. I can see them changing as I'm right before my eyes. And I think that has continued to have me keep going, as well as, you know, having a bigger impact and spreading this message so people can get help for trauma and brain injury. Because a lot of folks can't find therapists for brain injury. So if you're also a therapist and you want to do brain injury work, please reach out, because I need to refer people to you.
It's so good. It's so powerful. Thanks for saying yes, for being here, Jen. I've appreciated all of this and all the information you're sharing. And I'll be sure to link in the description and in the show notes all the ways and all the resources that Dr. Jen shared today will all be a part of the show notes. So thanks for being a part of Things You Learn in Therapy.
Thank you so much. This is awesome.
Take care.